Welcome to the Asymptote Podcast. As you might know, in January we celebrated the journal's fourth anniversary with events in London and New York, and in this episode we're bringing you some highlights from our evening in London. On January 19th, a packed house headed into the Free Word Centre in Farringdon to hear a conversation between some stars of the translation world, Daniel Hahn, Adam Thirlwell and Deborah Smith, hosted by Stefan Tobler, who's the founder of the publishing house And Other Stories. The theme was In Praise of Translation, and to kick off the evening, each speaker talked about a passage from their favourite translated book they'd recently read. So I'm going to take you now to London and hand over to Adam Thirlwell. Adam is an award-winning novelist, and he also edited a really wonderful translation experiment called Multiples. So here's Adam, reading from the book Almost Never by the Mexican novelist Daniel Sada, as translated by Catherine Silva.
Sex as an apt pretext for breaking the monotony. Motor sex, anxiety sex, the habit of sex as any glut that can well become a burden. Colossal, headlong, frenzied, ambiguous sex as a game that baffles, then enlightens, then baffles again. Pretense sex, see-through sex. Pleasure in the end as praise that goes against the grain of life lived. Conjectures cut short during a walk on a pale afternoon. Block after block, ascending, then descending. A strain in the step as well as the mind. The subject was one Demetrio Sordo, tall and thin, almost 30, fond of the countryside where he plied his trade with a modicum of pleasure, but for recreation, what thrills? Nightly games of dominoes in seedy dives, and those strolls, few and quite dull, of a mere mile or two, or a cup of coffee in the evening, always solitary and perfectly pointless, or the penning of letters to known but already ghostly beings. Hence a rut. And what should he do? Think? Already anticipating certainties and doubts, lots of naysaying and more reshuffling, all of which helped him find the spark he'd been lacking without taxing his brain on that overcast afternoon. Sex was the most obvious option, but the trick would be to do it every 24 hours, if only. A worthy disbursement indeed. So that very night, the agronomist went looking for a brothel. He went hesitantly. His mincing steps gave him away. He descended from the taxi and began walking as if on eggshells or as if the soles of his feet were being shredded by shards of glass. He found himself almost smack in the middle of the red light district, which was not even remotely Edenic and, to make matters worse, was dimly illuminated. This was only the second time he'd visited such an inferno, so he didn't know where to go. Casting about, the first thing he saw was a row of scruffy-looking women in ironwood rocking chairs, each one next to the open door of her own mean hovel. A sordid spectacle stretching along the sidewalk he had started down. Those mincing steps quickly turned into long strides, a sensible sprint motivated by his wish to find a high-class brothel. He stopped and asked a passerby. The man willingly obliged. That one over there or the other farther on, those are the costliest. Then came an exchange regarding the prostitutes he'd find in each. There were all kinds, though Demetrio preferred not to listen to more descriptions and instead took off a pace without so much as a thank you. And there they were, one brothel named La Entretenida and the other Presuncion, two yellow buildings like lumpy quadrangles that lent a touch of lustre to the twilight. So which would it be? A pleasant, somewhat extended quandary. He chose Presuncion. They charged an entrance fee as if it were a museum, a bit of a stretch. Then came a diffident handing over of cash. In exchange, the promise of instant happiness to ward off the gloom, for everything he'd so far fleetingly observed had made an impression, as did the grandeur of the suggestive orange-tinted salon with its many empty armchairs. There was piped-in music, but no dance floor. Ranchera music, exclusively, and ever so loud. And that's the first paragraph. I feel very much like the unqualified person on this panel, as the only person who's not a translator, but is just a novelist. And I've always been much more influenced, I think, by works in translation than, or in other languages, than I have been by probably British literature, certainly. And one of the things that I think is to find kind of forms that aren't actually kind of there in just your own language. And for me, Sada is a really interesting example of a kind of, partly the baroqueness of this compact, huge paragraph. So this is a very different way of introducing a novel than I think a British novelist would feel comfortable with. And also I think what really interests me, maybe in a lot of Latin American literature, is the way sort of philosophy or thought and narrative can intersect. So that a lot of these novels are trains of thought in the forms of novels. And that's one of the things that is interesting here because it is just a massive long block of language. So that's why I chose this one.
Thank you. That is a long train of thought. does he carry on sort of, are the sentences sort of...
His unit similar. In this novel, I don't know if this is in all the novels, it's slightly stile and direct libra, slightly interior monologue, so that you are always very closely tracking Dimitri's progress. And Dimitri's progress is basically to choose between whether or not he really prefers the... It's set in kind of rural desert Mexico in about 1945. And it's really about who he will marry, or more importantly, that he is half in love with a very upright, correct young lady who lives in a very repressed society, sort of village society, Renata, who is a virgin and gets upset when she even kisses her hand on the third occasion. As opposed to the whores that he is also in love with in the various brothels of Mexico. And so he's constantly in a tug between this. But the kind of, so the intro, I mean, and the plot literally finishes on his wedding night, that he finally gets to have sex with Renata. That's the plot of this very long novel.
You're saying it wasn't a very a particularly, because the cover has an upside down cross on, and Adam was saying it wasn't particularly religious. It sounds very Catholic to me.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, what you realise, the interest is the form, as it were, that the plot is so minimal, and around it there is this colossal outpouring of 400 pages of, and relentlessness is, I think, the figure you think of, that it's just constantly this sort of, I don't know, just a way of describing a thought process and a kind of obsession, so that actually you realise that gradually the kind of experience of reading and the experience of sort of anticipation that he's having in the novel become the same thing. So rather amusingly, the literal last line is simply a one-line sentence, which is sheer relief. and there's definitely a way in which the novel is an image of itself, as it were, that there is some kind of blockage being expressed by the style. Mm,
sounds brilliant. I'm looking forward to reading it.
We know how it ends, though.
We do, yeah. I have given away the...
I'll give it a few years and forget. Yeah.
And now we're going to skip forwards to hear Daniel Hahn present his favourite translation. Daniel is a highly lauded translator working from Portuguese, Spanish and French. He chose to talk about The Vegetarian by Han Kang, which was translated from the Korean by Deborah Smith. And as you're about to hear, it just so happened that both the translator and the author were sitting a few feet away from him at the time, which made for some great discussion and one or two pressurised moments. Here's Stefan handing over to Daniel.
But now we're going to look at a translation that is not imperfect.
No, it's a perfect translation. We're going to look at a perfect translation, and I haven't got any quotes from the translator because I've brought the translator with me, as it happens, rather conveniently. This is a slightly humiliating thing to have to do because I'm going to talk about a book translated by someone who's about 2 meters away from me, which I didn't know when I agreed, when I chose this book. I didn't realise that the author was also going to be in the room. So I'm just going to pretend they're not here, especially at the bit when I actually read their book to them. This is slightly foolish. It's the book which Ellen mentioned at the beginning. It's The Vegetarian by Han Kang and translated by Deborah, which I have chosen because it is, in fact, I think, the best and most interesting translation I've read in a while, and not even partly, because Deborah's here with me. One of the things we say when we talk about translation, especially to people who need the point of translation explained to them, we talk in a very vague and slightly thoughtless way, I think, about it opening up new worlds to us and new perspectives, and it's a way of getting access to new things. I think what Adam said about new forms is true, but I also think it's a very novelisty kind of way of reading too. I think you acquire slightly different things as a novelist to civilians. But I think it's, you know what I mean. But I think it's also true that while you read translated fiction in order to get things that may be different from what you can get at home, you also have access to them because they're also familiar. What Deborah she talked about, recognition. So The Vegetarian is a book set in a country I don't know, and it's set in a culture I don't know, which has structures I don't know, and which has taboos that I don't recognize as the same that we have. And so in that sense, it should be somehow very distant. It should be somehow quite removed from my understanding of things. But actually, of course, it's a book about people's responsibilities to one another. It's a book about change. It's a book about sex. It's a book about lots of things that are beyond or beneath the kind of structural or the cultural or the kind of circumstantial things that make up this book. It's a story, very briefly, of a woman who decides she's going to be vegetarian. And this very simple and very straightforward decision, I can't believe, I'm trying not to catch the eye of the author, it's slightly embarrassing. If I say anything really idiotic, just kind of turn away. It's about a woman who announces she's going to be vegetarian. She tells her husband this, and slowly everything around her unspools. Relationships, families, all of these structures on which are drawn very economically in the book before we watch them unspool. And it's about all of the kind of surprising and dramatic and quite dark ramifications of this announcement she's made. I'm going to read the very beginning and the very end and then just say something about the translation very quickly, I think. Before my wife turned vegetarian, I'd always thought of her as completely unremarkable in every way. To be frank, the first time I met her, I wasn't even attracted to her. Middling height, bobbed hair, neither long nor short, jaundiced, sickly-looking skin, somewhat prominent cheekbones. Her timid, sallow aspect told me all I needed to know. As she came up to the table where I was waiting, I couldn't help but notice her shoes. The plainest black shoes imaginable. And that walk of hers, neither fast nor slow, striding nor mincing. However, if there wasn't any special attraction, nor did any particular drawbacks present themselves. And therefore, there was no reason for the two of us not to get married. The passive personality of this woman, in whom I could detect neither freshness nor charm, or anything especially refined, suited me down to the ground. That's the first 10 lines or so. Can you tell me how to pronounce these names?
Yonghye and
Yonghye. Yonghye. I'll do my best, but I apologise. This is the last couple of paragraphs. Then Inye opens her mouth. "What I'm trying to say," she whispers to Yonghye. The chassis rattles over a hollow in the road. Inye squeezes Yonghye's shoulders. "Perhaps this is all a kind of dream." She bows her head. But then, as though suddenly struck by something, she brings her mouth right up to Yonghye's ear and carries on speaking, forming the words carefully, one by one. "I have dreams too, you know. Dreams, and I could let myself dissolve into them, let them take me over. But surely the dream isn't all there is? We have to wake up at some point, don't we? Because then..." She raises her head again. They're rounding the last bend in the road, leaving Mount Chuxiong. She sees a black bird flying up toward the dark clouds. The summer sunlight dazzles her eyes, makes them sting, and her gaze cannot follow the bird's flight any more. Quietly, she breathes in. The trees by the side of the road are blazing, green fire undulating like the rippling flanks of a massive animal, wild and savage. Inye stares fiercely at the trees, as if waiting for an answer, as if protesting against something. The look in her eyes is dark and insistent. The end. One of the things, I obviously don't speak Korean, I have not read this novel, so in one sense I have no idea whether this is a good translation.
Good.
I'm sure it's not. I'm sure it's an absolute travesty. But what I can tell, all I can do is I can consume this as a reader of English, and all I can tell is that there is something about this piece of English writing that Deborah has done. And I wanted to read that beginning and that end because of the difference between the two and because of the precision you can see what's happening in the language in the two. It may be that there is something quite different happening in the text that is behind it that I can't read. But what I can tell from the English is somehow the writing, the texture of the language, is doing exactly what it needs to do at each of the different moments it needs to do it. The
kind of rhythms of the prose change quite a lot in the book, and they change in ways that are exactly appropriate for what the book is doing. So in a funny way, Stefan was talking about imperfection. In a funny way, I can't tell you if this is a good translation, but I can tell you that this is sort of a perfect translation in that it is clearly doing something that works. There, a friend of mine was explaining a really good piece of writing to me not long ago, and he said, it's one of those things where, you know, kind of Prakrit would work on it. In other words, if you actually were to analyze it as a piece of practical criticism, the bits where the words are short are the bits where you want the kind of effect where the words are short, and the bits where the pace is doing something are the bits where you would want that. Everything is absolutely appropriate. And it's really lovely to read a piece of English. As I say, I have no access to the thing that it came from, but which feels like the writing in English is so controlled to suit the different voices, to suit the characters, to suit the changing pace of the book. And it's great, and you should read it. And Deborah's very clever.
A little later on, the discussion moved on to the relationship between author and translator, and we got to hear Deborah on what it was like to translate The Vegetarian.
Deborah, would you have been freer or differently free if your author, pretend she's not here again, if your author hadn't been around, available, reading, talking to you, would you have felt a different kind of responsibility then?
No, I think it would have been the opposite. I think I would have felt less free, especially, as you said, doing a first book, and for, you know, an editor like every other editor at a UK or presumably US publishing house who cannot read the original and has to just trust that my translation is accurately, whatever that means, representing the original. I can't prove that, you know, a choice that I've made is the correct choice. But I was lucky enough that Han Gang really appreciates translation as a creative act, as a kind of creative writing. And also the fact that Korean and English, just grammatically, syntactically, are so incredibly far apart, it kind of frees you from having to even think about being faithful to, you know, word order, word choice, kind of the stuff that I don't necessarily think is the most important thing in the book, particularly a book like that. So I could be instead faithful to, you know, tone or the atmosphere, the mood, something like that. So, yeah, I think it was definitely a more liberated process.
Okay, we're going to fast forward now to some questions from the floor. One audience member asked about the possibility of a translator being unfaithful to the original text, not by weakening the book, but by actually improving on the author's writing. Here's Deborah's response.
I think it's particularly difficult to talk about improving as well when you're translating from not just a language that is very different, but a literary culture that is also very different and has come from a completely different tradition. So there will be features that Korean readers will think of as good writing that English readers will not think of as good writing. So repetition, for instance, there's a lot more repetition in Korean than there is in English. And you have to remove that because it sounds like bad writing in English. But is that improving? I mean, how is that different from just translating, from creating the version that is in English? And then if you, you know, translated that translation sort of in a more literal way back into Korean, it's not improved because the Korean reader isn't going to think it's better because it's not for them. It's for the English reader. So I think, yeah, it's kind of difficult to even think of what would constitute improving in that sense.
But there is also a kind of imperial thing about really what we need is we want Chinese novels that are kind of like our novels.
Yeah.
We don't want them to be too long or too short or structured in a different way. We want Arabic writing that is sort of basically like the kind of novels we write in English. And there is that process of attempting to squeeze something into a form that we feel comfortable with, that our publishers think they can sell.
I think a lot of the metaphors used for talking about translation are very annoying. I think especially the two that really upset me are kind of when it's the praise of the smooth translation and the free translation, that it flows freely. And in thinking both cases, that kind of it's the improvement that you're talking about, which is not improvement, where there's an ideal of a very neutral English style. Mm. And I think that I think repetition is fascinating, because I think also it can go the other way, you know, like certainly into French. English actually can be, you can do effects with repetition. Mm. And then I've noticed with, you know, being translated into French or other languages, suddenly then that's being ironed out because they say you just sound kind of mad to a French reader. And, but then the other problem can be when you are like, I think what's interesting is often why you want to translate a text is because it is an original style in its, and that will mean that it's deformed slightly normal usage. Mm. And the thing that really kind of gets to me is when, as it were, that deformation of the normal usage is then being replaced by something freer because apparently it sounds odd. And again, I suppose it comes back to the worry about authority we're talking about. There's the worry that it'll sound just like a bad translation.
It's one of the reasons why we're sort of reassured by, what literary translators are reassured by Google, because the way Google works, Google Translate, is based on previous usage and probability and using this enormous corpus. And actually, in many ways, the most interesting writing is the stuff that's going to be using things in different ways and using rhythms and syntax.
One of my sort of common sort of questions when I'm translating something that seems unusual to me is to ask native speakers, you know, does that sound as odd to you in Portuguese as I think it does?
And then if it does, you need to make it sound strange in English. Mm. Right? Yeah. But I think also it is, there is a cultural thing as well where bad texts can become good. I mean, like the canonical example is Poe, I think, where maybe there are people who are going to disagree, but I find Poe an absolutely risible writer. Mm. Like a kind of, like just terrible and kind of always amazed that then when you read, you know, kind of Baudelaire's translations, Mallarmé's translations, they've completely changed, and it's not that they're mistranslating, but it's that in a completely different context. I mean, slightly, I think there is, I mean, there's, I've always been interested with Baudelaire that he often slightly changes the register. So where Poe has something like the imp of kind of, he translates imp by demon, a démon, and suddenly that slightly kind of gives it an aggrandizing feel, and it's no longer this kind of cutesy, slightly annoying kind of folkloric thing, but it's suddenly into kind of Baudelaire's kind of system of, philosophy. But I think that's an example where the cultural, there's something kind of by putting it into kind of a context of absolute literature, of kind of art for art's sake, and the way literature has been discussed then, Poe becomes a literally different writer, even though it's not been changed massively.
And finally, here's one last question from the audience about the Daniel Sada passage that Adam read at the start of the evening.
I was struck by the, during the reading, the lovely reading about sex, that two words really, really popped out. And one was, you're in a rut. And the other one was, I think it was luster. And I found myself wondering, you know, well, in English, these are wonderful words in this context, and they're loaded with connotations. And, you know, what was the original? We'll never know. You know, was the translator selecting these words because there was a similar wordplay connotation elsewhere in the text? Did it happen accidentally? You know, all these things, we'll never know. We have to accept what we're given, and in this case, it worked beautifully. I don't know if anybody else was struck by those particular words, but that's what struck me.
But I think that that's interesting, again, to come back to this improvement. I mean, I think there can be completely unexpected, I have no idea if that was in, but it could, if say it weren't, that seems to me not, that's fine. I mean, I think that often, you know, given that a lot will go, I think one of the things to always remember is there will be compensatory moments when actually the text has got improved unexpectedly.
And something like that, it's, you know, it's an opportunity that the language you're working in has given you to do with that passage that may not be there in the original language, but that you can tell from the rest of the book that the author, that is an appropriate choice, that is a choice the author could have made themselves if they'd been writing
given
it
half
in English.
A chance.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, it may be somewhere else, but it may be 10 lines earlier, 20 lines later. Mm. One of the things you do, I think, quite deliberately, is you think, well, I still owe the reader a pun.
Yeah.
And I'm 8 lines later, and suddenly you find something, two things that rhyme, and think, yeah.
I remember there was, actually, I once had a
tally.
I did a conversation on stage a couple of years ago with Julian Barnes about translation, and he told this wonderful anecdote about the translation of Flaubert's Parrot into German, where the translator had written to him, and there was a moment in Flaubert's Parrot where Flaubert is masturbating in Egypt. And And the translator came back saying, well, there's an idiom in German which would for masturbating, which would translate as to shake the coconut from the palm tree. And Julian said, go, this is much better than, you know, this is perfect. This is kind of,
you don't really have bishops in Egypt, so maybe yeah. you like to think of that.
But I like to shake the coconut from the palm tree.
It's amazing what translations can do. Do we have... How are we doing for time?
You can hear the full and unabridged audio from the event on the Free Word Centre's SoundCloud. And also, if you want to read more, I'd really recommend checking out Daniel Hahn's essay in our July 2014 issue about translating Paulo Scott's novel Nowhere People. There are also two chances coming up to meet and chat and drink with the Asymptote team in person. On April 7th, we have another anniversary event in Ottawa, and a week later we'll be at the London Book Fair to celebrate our nomination for the International Excellence Awards. If you're anywhere nearby, we'd love to see you there. You can find links to everything I just mentioned in the text alongside this podcast. Big thanks for today's episode go to our speakers Stefan Tobler, Adam Thirlwell, Daniel Hahn and Deborah Smith, everyone who works at the Free Word Centre, Ellen Jones and the other Asymptoters who helped organise the event, and our wonderful audience who came out to make it such a great evening. Our next issue will be out in July, and in the meantime there's plenty to enjoy on our blog, Facebook page and Twitter. Check it out, and thanks for listening.